I'm David Barsamian. Welcome to Interview. My guest is June Jordan. She's professor of African American Studies at the University of California at Berkeley, where she also directs the Poetry for the People program. She writes for the Progressive magazine. She's an award-winning poet and essayist. She has numerous books, including Technical Difficulties, Naming Our Destiny, Affirmative Acts, and Haruko, Love Poems. Her latest work is Soldier, a memoir of her childhood. Welcome to the program, June Jordan.
Thanks, I'm very happy to be here.
Soldier, what a curious title. Is this about some military activity that...
Yes, absolutely.
You've been hiding from the public?
Yes, it's about the military activity of my father raising me to be his son.
And was this... And he was an immigrant from Jamaica?
Absolutely. Well, actually came from Panama, yeah.
Panama, and your mother was from...
From Jamaica, yeah.
So you grew up in Harlem and Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
in a kind of, what, bicultural home?
Yeah, definitely bicultural, and definitely the home of immigrants to this country, which means that my parents, especially my father, arrived and stayed here, both with the highest possible expectations of this country, of democracy as he thought of it, and of his only child that he was raising, as I said, to be a successful person in the world. So he thought he probably would like me to have grown up to be a successful white man.
And you say that you were his helper, his sidekick.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, uh-huh. we were as close as fathers and sons get to be, I would say, probably. I was not as close with my mother. Obviously, that would have been too much of an acrobatic stunt. But on the other hand, she was there, and she was raising me to become a black woman, and she was raising me as a little black girl. So I had to early on develop a good bit of agility, you could say. But not more than most children have to.
Your connection was with your father, say the least, was problematic.
It was problematic, and it was also, I think, without any question, extraordinarily positive for me. My father was an amazing human being. He's a man who, when he came to this country, only in his late teens, he taught himself how to read and write. And he was self-made, I mean, truly. And at the time he came here, there were no resources available to him at all as a black immigrant man. And I absolutely know for sure that he did better than he could on the face of things, trying to raise a family and be a good husband and all of that sort of thing. And by me, his only child, I feel without question. I mean, his inordinate ambitions for me have everything to do with most of the really happy, productive aspects of my life that I'm still continuing to try to honor in his memory.
And you write that he hurt you and that you never knew why as a child.
Yeah,
do you know now?
No, I don't know why. I mean, he was extremely complicated human being, as you might expect from someone of that intelligence and passion. So he was also very violent. He was really violent and brutal where I was concerned. I don't know why he was violent as he was. I don't know. I can only conjecture now that my father had to withstand tremendous humiliation and also fear. I think my father was, this is just what I think my father was afraid that he would fail to prevent me from failing. I think that was really the root of his fear. And he didn't know really what to do to try to provide against the failure of his only child in this new land. And I think that probably contributed to the violence of his frustration, put it that way. But that he loved me and that he thought me capable of everything and anything, there was never any doubt.
Tell that story about the fat white policeman.
Yeah, my dad was walking me, you know, as a little girl walking down the street, and we saw this huge white man walking towards us, was really fat, and my father had already inculcated me with this idea that fat meant you were, you know, lazy, you were not a good person, and so forth. Plus, this man was white, and he was huge, and this was in Harlem. So I just went up to him, and I poked him in the stomach as hard as I possibly could, and I said, "Get away from me, fat man." And my father, I thought he would die, you know, because he probably was afraid he was going to be arrested or something. Maybe he was, I don't even know. But I remember he was so upset, I mean, he was laughing, but he was also terrified, my father. And I thought, it's interesting. I mean, I got it, that that was something I probably should not do again without some thought.
No, in addition to your work with him as a kind of...
My attitude towards police has
not changed. But in addition to sort of helping him with all these chores and carpentry and other things, he also cared about your mind. I was interested that he gave you two sets of second-hand books, one a set of novels by Sinclair Lewis, and the other a set of westerns by Zane Grey.
Yes, yes.
And you really took to Zane Grey, which is... Yes. Bizarre. It's very stunning. I mean,
it bizarre?
A little black girl growing up by that time in Brooklyn.
Yeah. You think
Zane
so?
Zane Grey? Well, maces, coyotes, cowboys.
Trails, ridges.
Exactly. Part of the Brooklyn landscape.
No, that's the whole point. That was the whole point, I couldn't imagine it. I mean, I couldn't imagine.
Open spaces.
I couldn't imagine it on the basis of where I lived and what our house was like and where we played. Even the backyard, I couldn't imagine. I never had seen a man build a fire, you know, as it gets dark, build a fire, you know, with his horse sort of nodding along nearby his shoulder, and I never saw any of those things. And I just thought, I want to do that. I want to see that. I want to be there. I mean, it seemed to me it would be free, and it would be huge, and it would be entirely different, and I wouldn't be alone because I'd have my horse. That was okay. I'd have my horse.
And you made money as a kid writing poetry.
Yeah,
How'd you manage that?
I was a little hustler. Well, in those days, parents didn't give children pocket money in general, and so you kind of had to figure out a way to make pocket money. I didn't get allowances. So, for example, I used to go around and collect people's bottles and bring them back for that kind of money. And then I found out that if you were dating somebody, you liked somebody a lot, some girl, and then you were not, like, into it anymore, and you wanted to say it nicely, and you came to me, and you explained to me what the whole thing was, and then I'd say, how long, you know, and we'd negotiate from 10 cents, 15, up to 25 cents would be very long, lengthy poem. And so I made some money. In that way, I got connected to people as far as what they're really feeling and jittery about or excited about, you know, things, matters of the heart. We're all children. And I loved that connection. And I was crazy about the fact that the other kids trusted me, really, that I wouldn't miscarry what they meant. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't miscarry it. That I'd do my best, you know. And mostly they seemed very happy with the product, and then they took it and they used it. So from that I got the idea also that... poetry could be useful.
And around that time, you know, the major figures, at least in African-American literature, were Langston Hughes, Richard Wright, Zora Neale Hurston. Any inspirations there?
No, because they all wrote fiction.
Well, Hughes wrote poetry.
Well, Langston Hughes, yeah, but I didn't, for some reason my father didn't give me Langston Hughes. I did not encounter Langston Hughes until... until I was in college. The black poet that my father gave me to study and memorize, it was Paul Ernst Dunbar, which is interesting. And I'm glad of it because actually the poems of Dunbar that he gave me had a lot of what at that time was called black dialect. So there was a tremendous amount of emphasis upon spoken language, the spoken language of black folks, you know. That was poetry, and that my father, the same father, mine, who gave me the sonnets of Shakespeare to read and memorize and deal with, gave me Paul Ernst Dunbar. And so I just took all of it as differences of music using English words, really.
Did your mother nourish you intellectually in any way?
Yeah, she did, but not the way my father did. My father was very, totally serious about it, you know, I mean, testing me every day, that sort of thing. He was absolutely serious about it, and no quit, Teutonic, actually. My mom was more religious, and she nourished me intellectually, I would say, almost by accident. It's because so much of the Bible and the biblical lore and values that she continuously immersed me in raised so many questions, as they always will, of any honest child, right? that in that way, do you know what I mean? It was intellectually provocative. I mean, for example, Daniel and the Lion's Den, that story. That's a very provocative story, I think, anyway.
In what way?
What was he doing there? I was like, where was his mother? You know, like that.
Why wasn't he at home?
Yeah, why was he doing in the Lion's Den? I'm like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, it was fascinating to me, like, because that's the way it was presented to me. Daniel in the Lion's Den, like, how did he get there? Why was he there? Where was his mother? Where were his people? Did he have any brothers? Because he seemed to be by himself. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And I that was not a known situation for me as a child. I mean, as a matter of fact, if, you know, from reading the story, it's only when my parents took me into a white neighborhood going to the beach that I saw children sort of my age without their parents. And I wondered about that. I felt, where are their parents? Because they appeared to be going to the beach, but I didn't see their mothers or their fathers. I didn't see that in our neighborhood, which was entirely black. You did not go beyond the block, except to go to school by a definite route, without your parents there. It was a different cultural thing.
And did they live?
And the Bible was different culturally.
No. Did your parents live to see your publishing and your success as an academic? And
no, unfortunately. I'm not sure it would have meant all that much to my mother, but to my father, I think it would have been, I think he would be quite pleased. Yeah,
so maybe you started off as a private, if we could use the soldier metaphor a little further, and today you're more of a higher ranking officer in his army?
I think I'm still a grunt, David.
Still a grunt.
I think I'm still a grunt, yeah.
Okay. Talk about what you see as the role of the poet and where June Jordan fits in society.
Well, I think the role of the poet to my beginning with my own childhood experience is to deserve the trust of people who know that's what you do is work with words, and to the trust of other people that you will not miscarry what they mean. You know, that's the first thing, and that you won't miscarry what they want. You won't say, this is what, I won't say, this is what David wants. If it's not, if I don't know that, I'll just say, this is what I want. Do you know what I mean? In other words, always to be as honest as possible and to be as careful about the trust invested in you as you possibly can be. And then I think the task of the poet, a poet of color, if I may say so, a black poet is also a poet of color, of a people hated and despised, I think, is to rally the spirit of your folks. I feel that more and more consciously over the last 10 years. I feel it's not okay for me if I'm despairing and angry and bitter to go out in public. That's not okay. It's like, no, I have to get myself together and I have to figure out an angle, a perspective that is an offering that other folks can use to pick themselves up again, do you know what I mean? To rally and to continue, or if even better, to jump higher, to reach more extensively, you know, in solidarity with even more varieties of people to accomplish something. I really feel, in a sense, I guess you could say, that it's a spirit task, in a way. I mean, I also do my homework, do you know? But I also, there's so much that I do homework about that is so horrendous, really. In fact, it's horrendous.
What is horrendous about it?
Oh, the inhumanity of people. Both here and elsewhere in the world, the inhumanity and the injustice, mostly not recognized, even acknowledged, you know, horrendous. So I do all this homework, and then I gotta go, to be useful as I see it, I have to figure out some sort of way to, as a poet and an activist, to shape that information so that folks can run with it, put it that way, can stand up and run with it, and maybe better resist the inclination to just feel absolutely overwhelmed. Because, you know, it's the more you know, as you know, David, the more it's really easy to feel overwhelmed.
One of the tendencies among progressives, for lack of a better term, or the left, is to engage in a kind of internecine warfare, rhetoric of purity, you know, I can't talk to you, you smoke, I can't talk to him, he eats meat, etc., etc. Yeah. Some years ago, you actually, so I think you kind of captured this, what I regard as an incredibly retrograde tendency in a poem you wrote from your collection, Passion, A Short Note to My Very Critical and Well-Beloved Friends and Comrades.
First they said I was too light. Then they said I was too dark. Then they said I was too different. Then they said I was too much the same. Then they said I was too young. Then they said I was too old. Then they said I was too interracial. Then they said I was too much a nationalist. Then they said I was too silly. Then they said I was too angry. Then they said I was too idealistic. Then they said I was too confusing altogether. Make up your mind, they said. Are you militant or sweet? Are you vegetarian or meat? Are you straight or are you gay? And I said, hey, it's not about my mind. That's still relevant, isn't it?
Still rings.
There are a lot of Stalinists out here, boy.
What accounts for that tendency?
Well, I think one of the things is a lot of people like to feel that they're right. And that's okay. You can feel that you're right, but don't get too comfortable in that. You know what I mean? I mean, unless you were really born of the Virgin Mary, I think you should chill a little bit. You might be wrong. You could say, this is what I think, you know? I also think that's the result also, I think, for all of us. Growing up in the West, we find ourselves inculcated in either-or habits of thought. Everything's dichotomized, right and wrong. You know what I mean? Black and white, good and evil, all that. So it's very difficult. You say, well, I'm not evil, so I'm good, right? And I'm like, no, you're not evil, but let's just leave it at you're not evil, or you're trying not to be. I mean, I would prefer. And even though actually in the New Testament anyway, speaking of the Judeo-Christian traditions of thought, that prevail here. There is the value of humility. We don't find that in this culture. There's no valuing of humility. You have to go east, you know? When you get into Hinduism and Buddhism and the Taoists, all of a sudden, which is most of the people in the world, you find that humility is a value that people are stone serious about, you know? And that anybody who violates that is at best a fool, right? So anyhow, I hope at least as far as intellectual interrogation goes, I hope more and more folks will go east a little bit and pick up on that.
Another poem from Passion, which interested me, was entitled Poem About Police Violence, the 90s and now 2000, with, you know, Rodney King, Abner Lima, Amadou Diallo, just seems to be an ever-recurring story. Maybe you could read that one as well.
Oh, boy. There's some of my students say to me, have you ever thought about police violence? I'm like, thought about it? Tell me something. What do you think would happen if every time they kill a black boy, then we kill a cop? Every time they kill a black man, then we kill a cop. You think the accident rate would lower subsequently? Sometimes the feeling like amaze me, baby, comes back to my mouth, and I am quiet like Olympian pools from the running the mountainous snows under the sun. Sometimes thinking about the 12th house of the cosmos, or the way your ear ensnares the tip of my tongue, or signs that I have never seen like danger women working, I lose consciousness of ugly, bestial, rabid, and repetitive affront, as when they tell me 18 cops in order to subdue one man, 18 strangled him to death in the ensuing scuffle. Don't you idolize the diction of the powerful? Subdue and scuffle, my oh my. And that the murder, that the killing of Arthur Miller on a Brooklyn street was just a justifiable accident again, again. People been having accidents all over the globe. So long like that, I reckon that the only suitable insurance is a gun. I'm saying, war is not to understand or rerun. War is to be fought and won. Sometimes the feeling like, amaze me, baby, blots it out, the bestial, but not too often. Tell me something. What do you think would happen if every time they kill a black boy, then we kill a cop? Every time they kill a black man, then we kill a cop. You think the accident rate would lower subsequently?
You wrote that in the early 80s?
Oh, no, man. This is way back.
Way, way back?
This is way, way back. This is like, I think it was 1974. I believe this is Arthur Miller. Yeah, I think it was 19, because I was teaching at Yale at the time. And I taught at Yale in 74, 75. It's just astonishing, you know. And then, you know, it was just last year, and we have Amadou Diallo in the vestibule of his home, apartment house, you know, in the Bronx, coming home after a long day standing on the street. And how many cops? And 41, they shot 41 bullets, and 19 of them lodged. And it was a justifiable accident again because he went for, they thought, a gun, and it was his wallet. And this beautiful boy, you know, another immigrant to this country, only came here because he thought he could, you know, and his mother let him come, right? Because that's a boy, you know, I mean, because she thought, here, surely he could have a more beautiful life, you know? Mm. And he was hoping to send money back to his family. I mean, it's just really...
And Abner Muima was
from Haiti. Yeah, okay, another immigrant. Mm. This is not a good track record with immigrants, particularly black immigrants, I don't think.
There was a case in Denver at a bus stop where some skinheads beat up an immigrant from Mali and killed him, and a white woman sitting by went to assist him, and she was paralyzed. She was beaten as well and is now paralyzed. A new kind of...
Can I say that I'm a good news black immigrant story? Just to balance things? I think I'm okay. I think I'm good news. I mean, as in that terms, I don't think this country has failed me at all. Yeah. I'm very grateful to all the chances I have here to try and make a difference. I really am.
A new crime, for white people at least, not new to African Americans who have long been subjected to it, is DWB, driving while black, this so-called racial profiling, which has come out in recent times. What do you make of that? I mean, you've been following this case in New Jersey.
What, driving while black? Yeah. Oh, man. Well, I think racial profiling is fantastic. I think it's something we ought to all be looking at and getting into. Let's all get into it. Because we do it all the time, all of us, I think, all of us, you know. We look, you know, like I see Andy and I see Ryan, I think, two white boys, right? And what do they think? Black woman. You know, there are things that go along with that. And this is racial profiling. We do it all the time. All of us do it. And I think it would be a really great thing to become more and more conscious, each of us, about how each of us does this. For example, at school this semester, that was the focus of our work in Poetry for the People, racial profiling. So we started with Wen Ho Lee. Right?
The scientist at Los Alamos.
The nuclear Chinese physicist. No. Who, I mean, he was supposed to be, you know, like Nicaragua was, you know, the number one threat to our national security. He's Chinese. And then, I mean, this is amazing. So you have the hip-hop black kid, you know, with the baggy pants and the hood and everything. Okay, he's like, he's wrong. And you have Wen Ho Lee, he's wrong. I mean, the whole gamut. And I like to suggest that then what's also going on in our heads and our attitudes and so forth also can have deadly consequences for every single person in this country, unless we start copping to it that we all do it. It's not just the police; we all do this racial profiling, and it is, I think, it is by its nature and by implication both annihilating.
You're very interested in the politics of the Middle East, and you've said that there's a racist double standard. There, and there's, quote, a clear valuing of one kind of life over another. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is what I mean by that. I mean that if anybody, anywhere, would just trouble himself or herself, just to get the United Nations resolutions, beginning with United Nations Resolution 242, okay, and just come all the way up to now, to this year, you would understand that there is a double standard in place here. Because beginning What was it, 1960? When was that?
242. The UN 242 was 1967. Calling for the withdrawal of all Israeli...
Unconditional and immediate withdrawal of Israeli troops from all the lands that they had taken during that war,
the June war.
Right. Mm-hmm. And from Lebanon. Unconditional and immediate withdrawal of Israeli troops. 1967, the United Nations Resolution 242 was adopted unanimously by the Security Council. It has never been rescinded. It is international law. It has never been enforced. All right? No one knows that. And not only that, that was just number one. And there's just a series, there's a whole series. I have a booklet like this, okay, just starting in 67 through now, of United Nations resolutions, where the only people who abstain ever, you know, are the United States and its little minion, you know, what's his name, Blair. You know what I mean? Everybody else in the world says, yes, I mean, and this is what I mean by one standard, is that if it's the law and you are called as a nation to be law-abiding, then everybody has to be called to be law-abiding. And that means no exceptions. There are no chosen people here, okay? They're just human beings and sovereign states to which one standard must apply. And if it doesn't apply, and if it breaks down so that everlastingly, the Palestinians and the Arab peoples, all right, are not seen as having just normal, regular human rights. Human rights. I'm just talking human rights. Okay. While the Israeli people are seen, the Israeli nation, I'm not speaking of people, the nation of Israel is seen as exempt from all law, national, international law. That perpetrates a racist disgrace that I think is the moral litmus test of my life. I do think so.
You're saying Palestine is the moral litmus test?
Yes, I think it is. I think that I can't think of another subject. I mean, I challenge you in the world today, or in our United States, that people approach with more trepidation and fear than that. Listen, it is a matter of fact. And this is not June Jordan talking. This is the World Almanac, okay? Including the completely disenfranchised Israeli Arabs. The total population of Israel is 5 million. Do you know how much aid the United States gives to Israel a year? This is according to the World Almanac, okay? It is over $4 billion a year. Half of that is outright grant, meaning... Now... For all the peoples of sub-Saharan Africa, all of them, which is what? It's over 100, what is it? It's 200-some million people. Do you know what the total amount of United States aid is to sub-Saharan Africa?
It's around 800 million. Is it that much?
It's not that much. It's 770-something million dollars a year. Most of it loans. Okay, you want to tell me that does not suggest a difference in the valuing of human life? You can't say that. These are not opinions. These are facts. Folks can go to your nearest Barnes & Noble or what have you. Don't do that. Go to an independent bookstore and just pick up your almanac and look. There's a page called United States International Aid. It's there. Look at it. And just look at the country. Look at the human population that resides in that country. And see where our monies are going, and notice whether or not there seems to be a racial consistency to the generosity of United States monies, and a racial consistency to the United States refusal of aid. This is in the context, by the way. This is in the context. This completely racist differential maintained by our country. This is in the context of an unarguable developing Holocaust in sub-Saharan Africa. This is not arguable. Do you know what I mean? The deaths that are taking place, they're just in the context of AIDS alone, all right, and that will take place within the next 10 years. This is not a joke. This is not arguable. And we, any of us who coexist with this, I say, talk about humility. How do you coexist with
On that note, I'm afraid we're out of time. Okay. I'd like to thank you very much, June Jordan, for joining us on Interview.
It's my privilege.
I'm David Barsamian. See you next time.